Headlines this hour, a prominent rights group says the International Criminal Court's ruling on its jurisdiction to probe Israeli war crimes is a real hope for victims. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson comes under pressure from the opposition Labour Party to end arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Also coming up, anger over the Indian government's agricultural policy shows no signs of letting down as farmers stage a nationwide roadblock protest. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate atrocities or war crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. The ruling can pave the way for the Hague-based tribunal to open a war crimes investigation, despite objections from Israel.
The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to examine possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shatta calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
Correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon, says the Palestinian governments and Hamas have welcomed the ICC's decision to investigate atrocities and war crimes committed by Israel.
Palestinians have welcomed this. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh welcomes it and said it's justice. This is a victory for justice and victory for humanity. Hamas movement has also welcomed this decision by the ICC. Hamas's senior official Rafat Mora said the decision is especially important because Israel has committed a terror and war crimes against Palestinians for more than seven decades. What's really important for Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they've been also under a tight and crippling siege, Israeli siege since 2007. And the siege by itself is a war crime and crime against humanity, according to human rights organizations and according to international law.
The UN has welcomed the U.S. plan to revoke its designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a terrorist organization. The spokesman, Stefan Duderich, says the move will help provide relief to millions of Yemenis in need of humanitarian assistance. The U.S. Secretary of State formally informed Congress about the decision to delist the Houthi movement. He says the decision follows a comprehensive review of the last-minute designation by the former U.S. administration. The department says the reversal is in response to Yemen's humanitarian crisis. Washington has also promised to halt its support for the Saudi and Emirati-led war on Yemen. The UN and humanitarian organizations had warned that the designation will push millions of Yemenis into a large-scale famine. Activist and political commentator Hossein Abulkheiti says the U.S. can stop the Saudi-led war in Yemen in a matter of days, but it refuses to do so.
As long as Saudi Arabia will stay out of the fire they created in Yemen, this means that they will continue their war against Yemen. And Saudi, most of their airstrikes that have killed thousands of civilians and the blockade against Yemen, it's under the reason that they are protecting themselves. They are targeting a ballistic missile factory. They are targeting drones factory, as they claim, in Yemen. And what Biden said, he's exactly saying the same, but he's putting it in a better and a nice sentence and nice words. Because what's actually killing Yemeni civilians, the main thing is the blockade on Yemen, which is enforced by Saudi Arabia with the help of the United States. And if the United States actually can stop this war in a matter of days, they can just order Saudi Arabia to stop its campaign against Yemen. They should not offer Saudi that they will support them to defend themselves, or as they say, their sovereignty from attack from Yemen. And on the other hand, we see that the United States is involved in the war against Yemen. They don't care about the sovereignty of Yemen. They don't care about Yemeni civilians. But this is exactly what the new administration is going to do. Biden is exactly the same as Obama, is exactly the same as previous President Trump. But at least Trump, he was clear, he was honest.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has come under pressure from the opposition Labour Party to end arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Labour's Shadow Foreign Secretary called the government's support for the war, quote, morally wrong, adding that it increasingly leaves Britain isolated on the world stage. This after U.S. President Joe Biden announced his plan on ending all weapons sales and support for Riyadh's devastating war in Yemen. The U.K. has so far failed to make any such commitment, but said it is concerned by the situation in Yemen. However, the chairman of the Tory Defense Committee in the House of Commons has said that London must not only follow suit in halting arms sales to Saudi Arabia, but also offer to work with the U.S. Washington's decision could leave Britain as key weapons supplier for Saudi Arabia after Italy ended such sales last week. Jahangir Mohammed is the director of the Center for Muslim Affairs, joining us from Manchester. We also have Saeed Shahabi, who is a political analyst and Middle East expert, joining us from London. Jahangir Mohammed, let me first start with you. So you have the U.S. that has said it's going to end its weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, wanting to take the first step in this case to stop the war, if that's going to indeed happen. Why doesn't the U.K. follow suit?
Well, I think, first of all, let's be clear. The United States has sold enough weapons to Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region. So in reality, Saudi Arabia probably doesn't need any more arms from the United States. It has plenty, and they've also supplied the Emirates. So it's a statement. A much better statement would be to call on Saudi Arabia to end the war and the others, and, you know, withdraw from the conflict. As far as the United States is concerned, the United Kingdom is concerned, I think obviously the United Kingdom has a different relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is probably even closer. And they have just come out of Brexit. They're looking for trade with everybody around the world. So I think they will probably take a long time to do that, if they do it at all. And of course, Western arms traders shift between countries. One country may impose a ban and the other one picks up the pieces. So, this is like an international cartel that finds a way of supplying weapons when they need to whilst making public statements. Of course, they need to condemn what Saudi Arabia is doing and the famine that's being caused, and to call Saudi Arabia to end this dreadful situation, as well as ending arms sales. But whether that happens remains to be seen.
Well, Sasha Hoppe, if the U.S. does indeed pull through and does what it says it's going to do, you also have Italy that has said that it's going to stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia. That would put the U.K. in the number one spot, I believe, for selling arms to Saudi Arabia. Is that a position that the U.K. wants to be known for?
Well, unfortunately, the U.K. has put itself in a very awkward position. To be party to the war is wrong. This is what the organizations here, like Stop the War Coalition, like CAT, Campaign Against Arms Trade, like Amnesty International, everybody is saying that you must not be there. There is absolutely no need for Britain to go and be party to the war on Yemen. This is number one. Number two, to supply Saudis and Emiratis with weapons that have been proven to be used against civilians, and that have caused one of the worst, probably the worst, humanitarian crisis in recent times in the region. To be there is again another ill-conceived decision. It is wrong. It is morally, ethically, politically, and militarily wrong. Because at the end of it is that we see now that the Saudis, the Emiratis, have been defeated. You put it in a nutshell, you put it in black and white, there is absolutely nothing to say except that the Saudis, after 6 years, have not been able to achieve what they wanted to do, and that is to remove the Ansarullah from power and to bring their puppet regime of Mansour Hadi back to power. So I believe that they are not doing service. The British are not doing service to the Saudis by supplying them arms and leaving them there to go deeper into the quagmire. So I think the call by the opposition on Mr. Johnson to stop arming Saudis is a right call, but it must be seen through. Mr. Johnson will be in a much better position if he is seen to be the figure that stopped the war, that led the war plug of the electricity of the main supply. So I think it is time. It is better late than never. So it is time for the British to withdraw their support from the Saudis and to be. They should just stop and pull out as quickly as possible in order to safeguard their reputation.
Jahangir Mohammed, given the close relationship that the U.S. has with the U.K., do you think that there's going to be any type of pressure of any sense by the U.S. for the U.K. to stop its support for Saudi Arabia in this war in any shape?
Well, I think it depends on whether, obviously, Joe Biden is making a lot of statements. He's just come to power. He wants to make a mark. He wants to show there's a shift. It really depends on whether this public statement have any meaningful expression on the ground, and whether they are really committed to that. In which case, maybe there will be some pressure later on, and the UK does at some point tend to toe the line with the United States. But I don't think we should be fooled by just statements. I think. We need to see the practical results of that and whether, in fact, the U.S. actually encourages or pushes other states in Europe to stop their arms supply. As I say, the arms trade is not a moral trade. It's immoral, but at the same time, it's a major means of income for the United States and Western states. The top five, include Britain and the United States and France, and they usually find a way of selling weapons to somebody. So I think it depends on the level of commitment and whether these statements are superficial. But of course, it is immoral. What's happening, and there's no doubt that it should be stopped, but we need to go much further and stop this terrible conflict that's taking place in Yemen that's caused so much suffering and so much famine to innocent people, and let the people of Yemen decide their own future. I think you can't suppress people who want to be independent, who want to be free, who want to determine the direction of their own country. This is the lesson of history. You have to find political solutions, and the sooner that this external interference stops, the quicker the people of Yemen will be able to find a solution to their own problems.
Okay, very well. Thank you for that, Jahangir Mohammed, Director of the Center for Muslim Affairs. Saeed Shahabi, thank you. Political analyst and Middle East expert from London. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Indian farmers are holding fresh nationwide protests against the government's controversial agriculture reforms. The demonstrators have blocked many roads and highways with sit-ins to pressure the government to repeal a set of laws enacted in September of last year. Farmers argue that the measure will benefit large private buyers at their expense. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Office called on Indian authorities and protesting farmers to exercise maximum restraint. The months-long protests have mostly been peaceful, but a tractor rally on the 26th of January turned violent, leaving one dead and hundreds injured. Some protesters also stormed the capital's historic Red Fort. Since then, authorities have shut down the internet in parts of the national capital and have had heavily barricaded roads to prevent them from entering the city again. Munawar Zaman says farmers' protests are gaining momentum all across India.
The protests is gaining a lot of momentum across several parts of the country. And as we speak, there are several states in the country where sit-in protests are happening, where people are sitting on the middle of the highways, blocking the highways. They want their voices to be heard. They want to make sure that this movement becomes successful, which the government says is being instigated by vested interests. That's what the government says. They say there are certain vested interests which want to break the country, but the country stands united. But it's amid the backlash by the international community as well. The United Nations has spoken today, calling on the government of India to restrain, abstain from using excessive force, to exercise maximum restraint as much as possible in dealing with the farmers.
Thousands of Myanmaris have taken to the streets in the largest city of Yangon to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Protesters chanted slogans against what they called military dictatorship and demanded the army hand power back to the elected politicians. They also called for the release of Suu Kyi and other officials detained since Monday. The rally was the biggest street demonstration by an anti-coup campaign launched by students, teachers, and workers. The coup and detentions followed escalating tensions between the government and the military over the last parliamentary election. Meanwhile, the UN has made its first contact with Myanmar's military since the coup, urging the junta to release the leaders. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has branded the coup as absolutely unacceptable. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In 2003, America entered into a war with a country its citizens could barely locate on the map. War was initiated to find Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, something that was never found and actually never even existed. Yet the American invasion of Iraq let the genie out of the bottle, resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths, the destruction of a whole nation, and insecurity and instability for a region which has continued until this day. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. As Washington's beating of the war drums raged, Lorna Tychostuk, a single mother and news and politics editor for a local arts magazine in New York, knowingly risks her life, imprisonment, and even a $1 million fine by traveling to Iraq under the threat of war, and on a mission to capture and bring back the face of the Iraqi people for the American public to see. Stay with us for this week's extraordinary and inspiring documentary as Lorna returns with images of ordinary Iraqis that she hopes will sway people against this invasion.
Then, honestly, I wasn't sure where Iraq was on the map. Nobody I knew where Iraq was on the map. I had never met an Iraqi person, and all I thought was, like, what do they look like? We're going to be killing them. We're going to go to war in a country that I know nothing about, and why? And I really had this sense that if I took enough pictures and I got them in enough places and I showed enough people who the United States would be killing, who we, America, would be killing, that it might help to stop the war from happening. I don't know, I guess I've always been this way. You know, speaking out, I always felt like I was riding the cusp of history. I was watching, I was living history.
You saw the television news pictures of last Saturday's anti-war protest. No one disputes that it was sizable and that, for the most part, it was peaceful.
States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. Any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
What if your wife or your mother told you that she was headed to Iraq for 2 weeks? Well, three New York moms who call themselves the Hudson Valley Peace Brigade are headed there tomorrow for a 10-day mission of what they're describing as peace. Are you going to ask them, why did you guys ignore 17 UN resolutions? Why did you guys wait 12 years? Why do you refuse to disarm your nuclear program, your biological and chemical program? Do you plan on asking them that?
No, I don't. I'm going there to see the people. I'm going there because these people aren't going to be liberated. They're going to be annihilated.
This is left-wing propaganda. You know what? America freed the world from the Nazis. We freed the world from totalitarianism, the former Soviet Union. We freed the world of fascism. And we're going to free these people, the ones you care about. They're going to be liberated.
Listen, I think that when you start dividing it into left and right, that's not the issue here.
But you are a leftist.
Why are we here discussing what our labels are? You can label me anything you want to diminish my argument. I don't want to go to Iraq. I'm going to Iraq because, you know, I feel the people like you, the people who have the money, the networks that have the power, how come they're not going to this country and showing us? They only show us the maniac. They don't show us the faces
of the people.
Well, he is a maniac.
I mean, he is a maniac. Let's not put that aside.
But
he is a maniac.
There are families there. I would tell our government to please let the weapons inspectors continue to do their job.
Ladies, I wish you get home safe before the war starts, because war is coming. And I mean that sincerely. I hope you get back safe. And coming up, Secretary Ridge raised the threat level to high today. Does this mean you should stay home and lock the doors?
You know, I had always wanted to be on that show. Because I'll sit here and watch Fox, you know, Hannity and Combs, and want to throw my shoe at the TV half the time. Because they get people, they interrupt them, they berate them, they just get their message, right?
Yeah.
So instead, I interrupted them.
Okay, my name is Lorna Tychosta. I'm going to Baghdad because, as a photojournalist, I feel it is my responsibility to go there and bring home the face of the Iraqi people to the American public.
I was wondering if you're concerned about being a casualty of your own government.
I think that right now we're all collateral damage. The Wall Street Journal's poll, 73% of the people in this country do not want unilateral attack of Iraq. We love our country. We live here, too. We are three mothers. We've got six kids between us. We love those kids. We want to come home.
The community here has been unbelievably supportive, I think partly because these three women are so brave and bold. But, you know, a lot of people can't go to Iraq. A lot of people can't leave their lives. These three people are risking their lives to go to make a very powerful statement.
You're going to Iraq? What or what?
I'm going to Iraq.
Really?
That's why they're filming me.
Why are you going to Iraq?
I met Lorna maybe 10 years ago. She was a single mom working as a waitress at a local restaurant.
Because we're going to go there as, you know, I'm a journalist, so I'm going to go and take some pictures and bring home some photos and hopefully maybe stop this war insanity.
Lorna is the editor of the political section of Chronogram, a local magazine of arts, culture, politics, kind of the village voice of the Hudson Valley. Lorna has charisma. She has loads of charisma. Lorna has not gone to journalism school. Lorna has not gone to charm school. What Lorna brings to any situation is this almost animal ferocity. She goes after a story like it's nobody's business. She doesn't stop. She'll keep calling people. She wants to know why. Lorna's somebody who knows how to take care of herself very well. And she had said explicitly to me, I have two kids. I love my life. If the war starts to happen, I'm coming home.
My daughter, Lacey, she's 18 and a half years old. My son, Josh, is 22 and a half years old. They both go to the University of Binghamton. They're not happy. You know, they're afraid for me. They're afraid for them. Years ago, like in 95, I traveled in Mexico and I kind of fell into the Zapatista revolution. So I came home and I told them about that. So they've been kind of living like this is what their crazy mom, you know, does.
She's always wanted to go places and see things that I guess she felt that people should see. So I guess you just kind of have to go with it.
The pressure, gosh, the pressure of my kids, that is killer. You know, I know my daughter does not want me to go to Iraq.
Like, whose mom goes over there and why? I mean, besides stuff you see on TV, it's not really something typical of people you know.
I got married very young, and I got married, you know, for ridiculous reasons, because I was trying to please and obtain love from my mother.
So I did all the good things. I got married, and then a couple of years later, you're supposed to have kids. I've paid my dues. Like, I want to do things that I want to do.
She always told us from when we were younger that whatever we wanted to do, we could do it. We wanted to be a coal miner or an artist or whatever, that she would be supportive. It's interesting now that whatever she's doing, I'll support, but I guess that's how it worked. She's, like, definitely an irreplaceable person.
The only road all the way across the desert. I've been told that this is a 12-hour journey. The driver drives 100 miles an hour. This, for me, is probably the scariest part of the trip because it looks like it's a vast wilderness of unknown territory. And we're going to end up in Baghdad. I always wanted to go and go to places and see for myself and maybe bring back whatever I saw. I shot 45 rolls of black and white, 30 rolls of color. I get very close to people even if I don't have even more than a split second to take their shot. I mean, I live with them after that. I take the shot, and then later I see them develop. And they develop within me, and I carry them around. On February 15th, we had a 200-person international march for peace. We joined the rest of the world. And at one point, it was really interesting. I mean, somebody turned around to me, and they were like, wow, this is like it. Like, the epicenter of the peace movement comes from Baghdad. And then, of course, you know, to go back to the hotel later that night and find out that, you know, 20 to 30 million people around the world had been doing the same thing.
Today in London, 2 million people have marched against this war. That is one out of every 25 human beings in Britain. In Rome, as we speak, there are another 2 million people marching. And in Spain, the third of George Bush's allies in Europe, there are 1 million people marching against the war.
Producers that I spoke to, she said that at noon on February 15th in New York City, where all these millions of people were totally shutting down, vast amount of blocks, they get a little phone call from NBC saying to cut the live feed.
Our next guest just returned from a two-week peace mission in Iraq. We want to welcome Lorna Tychosta back to the show.
You came back from Baghdad. You stayed there for how long? 2 weeks?
I was in Baghdad.
Okay, now, in my opinion, you seem like a lovely woman, but in my opinion, your visit bordered on treason. What were you thinking going there?
Oh, please. You know, I'm an American. I have a constitution. What makes you think that I should not be able to travel someplace on this planet? We have freedom of speech. This is a free country. You're telling me that this is treason?
If you oppose America's policies, that's fine. You can protest here all you want, because that's free speech protected under the First Amendment. That's fine.
No, I'm an American.
But to carry your protest to enemy territory when we are on the eve of war seems to me villainous and bordering on treason.
Well, that makes great play here on TV.
But it's true. Don't you understand that what you did was aiding and abetting the enemy?
Absolutely not. I'm an American.
My going there was illegal. So what is it? Up to $1 million and 12 years in jail for going someplace and bringing back the truth?
And I guess it comes down to the fact that if we were all sitting here and we were about to be bombed, I'd certainly want some group to rise up and make it not happen.
I'm in the process of setting up a college tour. I'll go around the country even if I have to and show these photos. And I really think that even people who want war, once they look at these photos, there will be people who will change their minds.
There's nothing in the country.
They have raw sewage floating in the streets.
with such poverty, such desolation. You can see the stress in the eyes of every Iraqi person. You see this exhaustion and this fear. And the American public has to go and see. I think they have to go to Iraq and see this for themselves. Don't listen to me. You know, don't take my word on it.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. We will defend our freedom, we will bring freedom to others, and we will prevail. May God bless our country and all who defend her.
I believe in war. I believe there are times when you need to defend your land, your home. I don't think this was one of those times. I was actually in the dark room the night that we started bombing. It kind of stunned me that at that point, like a silence swept across the land. It stunned me that I felt I wanted to be silent too. If any of them are dead, they'll still live. And I think that's why I made so many, so that like everybody who has them, in some way, they won't be forgotten. I wanted it to be true that the Iraqis were happy we were there, that the fighting was going to stop now, and that we could have peace and things would be better. Like a little kid, I wanted it to be okay.
In Baghdad today, the search continued for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
So growing concern here, they won't find the massive quantities of weapons that were the major justification for the war.
The one thing I felt was missing from my work were the stories of the soldiers. That summer, I drove to North Carolina to Camp Lejeune to interview Marines. Half of what I do, or more than half of what I do, is because I take it to the personal. Like, I don't want my kids going to fight some old rich man's war.
Are these Americans that are so frightened that they're sending these children off to fight for them, are they willing to look at the photographs that they bring home of the dead bodies that they've killed? We don't want to look. We don't want to see. Send them off. Let somebody else fight for us so that we'll be safe. I think that that's a crime. I think that's a criminal activity. What do we do? You know, what do we...
We should have never went in.
We should have never went in.
Period. And just let the country be.
My son was in the invasion and... when we invaded Iraq in the beginning of the war. He was a driver of a 3rd Humvee in line going to Baghdad. His battalion was part of the battalion that got pinned down in Nasiriyah for 11 days in a firefight. During the war, didn't sleep. I became a CNN Fox News addict. Finally, I just had to turn the TVs off. He came back with 11 ribbons. A lot of souvenirs, a lot of pictures, a lot of nightmares. To this day, he still has them. Because you don't hear anything about the guys that came back, what's missing the legs, the arms, and stuff like that. You know, there's nothing in the media, there's nothing in the newspapers, nobody talks about it. What are you going to do? You know? Say a prayer.
You know, I went in the beginning to bring home the face of the Iraqi people. Now I want to go and bring home the face of the soldiers, because that's got to hit home here. The armored personnel vehicle that I drove around with, I went out on patrol. We left at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is probably the worst experience of my entire life. So we rode around in this heavy-duty tin can that was spewing diesel fuel out of here. Over here, there's a hatch that you can stick your head out of. You want to see the bullets and mortars coming at you. There was no heater in the vehicle. They had had a heater. It had broken. You know, these guys are driving around. It's very cold there, and they don't need your goddamn ribbon. They need you to send them some money for a heater, or at least to write your congressman and your congresswomen and say, could you please make sure our troops are being taken care of over there? And they need letters. They need emails. They love it. They want to know that America even knows they're there. So we rode around the village, you know, waiting to be shot at. You know, we got back around 11 o'clock in the next morning. That night when I tried to sleep, my body hurt more than it's ever hurt from any flu I've ever had in my entire life.
And I think it was a combination of riding around in a heavy-duty tin can and also that I had poisoned myself with adrenaline. Because at any given moment, we were told, you know, we could be shot at.
How do they feel?
They're out in the streets. I spoke to some who are terrified. They're being shot at. They're under threat of mortars landing on their bases, car bombs going off around them. You know, most of the ones I spoke to want to come home. And do you know that there's a law that that the Bush administration has enforced? The Clinton administration didn't enforce it. That you cannot film or in any way capture the caskets with the flags on them. We're not allowed to see this. The media is not allowed to capture these images. That's a good question. Well, I don't know. Why? Should you not be seeing death on your TV?
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear brothers and sisters, thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. Speaking of lanterns, which we always do speak of on this show, thus the name, or whether it's because it is called lantern that we keep speaking of the object. In any case, one of the lanterns a believer must possess through their life journey is the lantern of wisdom. So much so, in fact, that there's a very interesting hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where His Eminence has said, wisdom is the lost object of a believer, and a believer may never find peace until he finds that lost object of his, which is wisdom. And wisdom holds such an important position in the life, in the formation, in the growth of a believer, that The Ahl al-Bayt alayhim as-salam have advised us to seek it from whatever, through whatever means, from whatever source. Now, this is a very tricky idea because one would think, well, something might sound wise, but it could be from a tyrant, an oppressor, an atheist, a non-believer, a person who has a corrupt worldview. And their meaning and purpose in life isn't only not in accordance with our purpose and meaning, but it's actually in contradiction with our purpose in life and the teachings of our religion and what we hold as criteria and value. That is a very important matter for us to constantly pay heed in and be aware of. But before we continue with our discussion, let's listen to an interesting story that will, you know, inspire us to look at the concept of wisdom and its position in our lives more deeply. We'll be right back.
The Man in Search of Tree of Life is the title of today's story. A learned man once told a story saying, in India there is a certain tree, whoever takes and eats of its fruit will never grow old or die. A king heard this tale. He became a lover of the tree and its fruit. He sent an expert envoy to India in search of it. For many years his envoy wandered about India in search of the tree. He roamed from town to town for this purpose. No island, mountain, or plain was left unvisited. Everyone whom he asked mocked him, saying, "Who would search after this unless perhaps a madman?" After he had suffered much fatigue in that foreign land, he finally became too exhausted to seek any longer. There was a wise man at the halting place where the king's confidant fell into despair. The envoy said, "As I have no hope, I will go to him. In order that his prayer and blessing may accompany me, since I have no hope of fulfilling my heart's desire," with tearful eyes he went to the man. The man laughed and said to him, "Oh, simple man, this is the tree of knowledge, very high, very great and very far spreading. It is the water of life from the all-compassing sea of God. You have sought for the form. You have gone astray. You cannot find it because you have abandoned reality. Sometimes it is named tree, sometimes sun, sometimes it is named sea, sometimes cloud."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So there's a hadith from Ali alayhi salam. Once again, His Eminence says, "Don't look at who's saying something, look at what is being said." This hadith helps in the sense where we have to be able to look at things objectively and not get our prejudice and bias and, you know, personal inclinations involved when we want to seek out knowledge, when we want to acquire wisdom, when we want to better ourselves. Sometimes a word of wisdom could even be from the mouth of the infallibles or from the Quran itself, but it might not sit very well with us. So the fact that something doesn't sit well with me doesn't necessarily have to be the criterion for whether that thing is wise or not, or whether that thing is going to be constructive for me or not.
However, this narration from Ali alayhi salam has to be put into context. If we look back in history, there have been many instances where the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt would try to use the words of God and the noble prophet against them. And in those instances, Imam Ali alayhi salam would say that this is a just word, but it is being used for corrupt means and purposes. So we have to be able to discern between the occasions and where we should place the advice of the Ahlul Bayt regarding not looking at the source of wisdom and looking at the wisdom itself. Because a lot of times someone could sugarcoat their own misleading ideas, and they could adorn it and dress it up so nicely and present it to the world that when we, at first glance, it seems like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Maybe I should be listening to this, even though a total atheist, or I'm not saying that all atheists have corrupt objectives, but there could be people who are actively trying to manipulate the thoughts and the beliefs of the people and the masses for their own gains and benefits. In that case, we really need to be more aware and more careful. We need to be able to pick and choose. And in order to do that, religion provides us with a tool referred to as Furqan. Furqan is the sense, the ability to discern between right and wrong, which develops in a human being once they have practiced piety. If a person makes it their life habit to constantly prioritize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and be careful to make the right decisions in life, that ability to discern between right and wrong, even during ambiguous situations, will occur in them. And with the help of God and with the inspiration of God and with all the principles that they've developed within them through their practices and their studies and the whole process of gaining knowledge, they will be able to tell right from wrong when it really calls for it. Now, back to the importance of wisdom. Even if we look at it from a psychological aspect, we need to. Wisdom still holds a very important and salient position in the human life. And to understand why does it have such a principal status, we have to understand what wisdom itself is. Wisdom is the understanding, basically, and the knowledge of that which is true. First, we have to accept that there is a truth in the universe, and then we have to gain a degree of knowledge toward it. We have to be able to establish within ourselves a sense of good judgment. So that goes back to the ability to look at something objectively without bias or prejudice. And another thing that categorizes as wisdom and goes under that title is the ability to learn from life experiences and our mistakes. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for tuning in. Until another greeting, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.